the Representing Rural podcast by Rural Community Alliance, and we're continuing our series of talking to elected officials, people who are running for office, specifically in rural communities across the state of Arkansas. And today I have the pleasure of talking to Representative David Toilette, who is my current representative for District 12, right?
That's yes.
Number. District 12 in Arkansas. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you having me on. I love the opportunity to talk to all constituents every chance I get.
Yes. Glad to talk to you. I just want to say thank you, because I know you probably have an in-service. Well, in-service is coming up, and then you tried to have a vacation and all that stuff. So I want to thank you for taking time to talk to me today. Okay. So let's just get started. So the Legislative Council, a couple weeks ago, they voted to make the school district use ESSER funds for one-time employee bonuses. Given the fact that those dollars might be already obligated for other needed projects and services for schools, I just want to know your thoughts on that, decision that they made.
Well, I think that was a hasty decision by a small amount of legislators. I don't think that was really good decision-making, and I don't think it was something that was discussed really with educators prior to that decision being made. Most ESSER funds, ESSER 1, 2, and 3 funds that came from the federal government and went to schools were for specific reasons, and superintendents across the state of Arkansas have really obligated those funds to help with the security and safety of our students through COVID, to be able to pay for extra duties such as cleaning, for extra time, and then most recently, especially ESSER 3 funds, because most districts in the state of Arkansas have already spent all their ESSER 1 and 2. ESSER 3 funds were used primarily for to make up lost learning opportunities for students. And so most school districts have had summer school, they've done credit recovery, they've put together after school tutorings, and a wide variety of different things that they've offered to parents and students to help with the learning loss that we're seeing with our students here in the state of Arkansas. And so those funds have pretty much been going to our students' safety and to help catch up on the learning loss. I do believe that the teacher is the number one determinant in helping students get caught up. And I applaud their intent to be able to help pay educators, but I don't think that's what educators were asking for. A one-time bonus is not really going to do a lot to help recruit and retain educators across the state of Arkansas. Most educators across the state of Arkansas will never see that money. The wealthy districts will probably be able to pay some bonus, and I'm not going to say what that may be. They may be able to meet the legislative intent. But I would venture to guess most school districts are not going to be able to do anything. And if they do, they're not going to be able to meet the legislative intent. So I don't think that it's going to be very effective. I do believe that there was some maliciousness within certain legislative members to be able to put this process in place. And I've seen the guidance that the Arkansas Department of Education has basically issued on this, which is, you know, either you meet the intent or you have to explain why you didn't meet the intent, and then possibly be dragged in front of a small group of legislators who are probably going to berate superintendents over why they didn't spend the money, when in actuality the Arkansas Department of Education issued guidance contrary to what the Legislative Council did.
So the overall process of that the Legislative Council voted on is for districts to come before them and tell them their plans of spending this money, and have a valid reason, for in their opinion, if those funds aren't spent on these bonuses?
Yeah, so the Legislative Council put into place a requirement. School districts are to pay, well, it's a strong recommendation. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a requirement, but basically you pay teachers, full-time teachers, $5,000, and then all non-certified, $2,500. This also doesn't take into account, nor did they mention the match. And as a former superintendent, this is concerning as well, because it's not just that you're paying $5,000 of ESSER funds out to, say, a teacher. You also have to be able to meet the match, which is about 30%. So where the extra $1,500 comes from for that $5,000 bonus that would be issued to teachers is a concern. I mean, where they didn't lend it out to be or to come out of ESSER funds, so it may just have to come out of general revenue, which most districts don't have.
So you said the district has to match a certain amount of the $5,000.
Right. So anytime a school district gives a bonus, let's just say they give a $1,000 bonus, it actually costs the district around $1,300 to give that $1,000 bonus, because they have to pay into teacher or the teacher retirement for the employees. They have to pay for insurance. I mean, like a variety of different things that come with that match. And so it's around 30% depending on the employee, but it costs more to give than just the face value of the bonus.
The flat rate that we all see. Okay, so why is tackling teacher pay so important, and what's the impact of Arkansas's low teacher pay? I know you have seen some of your posts on Facebook with the billboards, and I think Representative Fred Love did the same thing, and I noticed them too when I was in Little Rock. So yeah. Speak on why tackling teacher pay now is so important. What's the impact of Arkansas's low teacher pay in the region?
Right. So it's several things, actually. The first thing is, since 2015, the legislature has been putting money into teacher pay. And it's important to note that, but it has not kept up with inflation and the increase in, especially through COVID, in what other employers are willing to pay. And so now we're to the point where we are the lowest paid in the region. All the states around us have higher starting teacher salaries than we do. And you see this through the billboards, like you mentioned, in Little Rock and other places, of other states advertising to recruit our teachers because they pay way better than what we did. And we saw this play out more so with the state of Mississippi, who, I mean, we've always said, thank God for Mississippi here in Arkansas. But right now, I think Mississippi is saying thank God for Arkansas, because they just raised their minimum teacher pay to $42,000, which is $5,000, or actually $6,000 more than what we pay our teachers starting here in Arkansas. And if you really look comparatively, basically, a teacher starting out at $36,000 would make the same as a person who doesn't have a college degree, who may be working at a gas station for $18 an hour. They would make the same amount as a college degree teacher who has student loan debt coming out. And so it's just not a good look for especially our rural school districts who can't afford to pay their teachers more. And it's created a teacher shortage in rural Arkansas. And it's most notable, of course, in the Delta and in South Arkansas. Most of your central and northwest Arkansas school districts do pay their teachers a living wage. And it's important to know that. And we're thankful for that. And we're glad that they can get their teachers up there where they can afford to live. But in rural and South Arkansas, it's just not the case. And there are ways to address that. And we're just not seeing that being addressed with the urgency, I believe, that it needs to be addressed with. Because right now we're seeing teachers leave this profession in the state of Arkansas at unprecedented rates. And I think it's starting to cause a little bit of an emergency situation. And we're seeing it nationwide as well.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say is the legislature's responsibility, like right now? What would you like to see? And I've seen a few interviews from legislators on Talk Business and Arkansas Week discussing this. But there seems to be a consensus that they are wanting to wait until the next legislative session to really address it. So what are your thoughts on that? What would you like to see the legislature do regarding teacher pay and retention and all of that?
So, you know, I think the bonus was kind of a cover up for the present. I don't think that really addresses the issue. We're blessed in Arkansas to actually have a state surplus of money, which most states haven't had. We've done extremely well cutting expenditures and being able to cut taxes as we've gone along. But we're blessed with the surplus of money that we didn't expect. Our next financial forecast is looking extremely well. So I think the time to act is now. And with basically a $600 million surplus that we can deal with or address issues with now, I think we need to take action. And the state's own adequacy report bears out that the number one reason that people don't want to go into the education profession in Arkansas and are leaving the education profession in Arkansas is teacher pay. And so why not address that now as opposed to waiting? And there's no doubt in my mind that, and I understand that there's a process, because through the Lakeview lawsuit, the state of Arkansas is required to go through a process to determine adequacy and what needs school districts have. However, they can address that now. I mean, we already know that it bears it out in adequacy report. It doesn't need to be studied, because we can look around at all the states around us that we're in competition for teachers with and see that their base pay is higher than our base pay. And so we have the ability and we have the finance to be able to address this and really even pay for it for not only this upcoming school year, but the next school year. And there's no doubt in my mind that once the adequacy process is done, that I believe you will see increase in teacher pay. My concern is, and my question is it just going to be like $1,000? We're going to bump you up another $1,000 per year for 2 years, and you're still going to be thousands under the nearest lowest paying state around us? Or are we going to actually address the issue and we're going to pay our teachers a livable wage? And so that's my question. And most of your legislators that have responded to teachers say, well, we're going to address this and we are going to increase teacher pay. Yes, that's fine to say that, but are you going to pay them a living wage? That's the big question.
So if I was in conversation with someone this week about not just the teacher profession, but professions overall, the newer generations. And so they're not staying in jobs for 20 years like my parents did, or 25 years. And it was an interesting conversation, because they said that is how we should address not just the teacher shortage, but all like professions where people are staying for like three, four years now. So it should be like this ongoing investment in a pipeline, with that thought of, okay, I have this person now, but in 3 or 4 years, you know, I won't have them. So do you feel like that is a model that that we should start using or thinking about when thinking about, especially the teacher profession in rural areas? Like, okay, this person won't be here 20 years, so we need to, it's ongoing, you know?
I think that that's a good model to use. I think that, the governor's plan, and I will say this, he at least tried to get action taken now, and I will commend him for that. I wish he would put it on the call. He did not. I wish he would have used his political clout going out to push harder for teachers, but he chose for whatever reason not to do that. I will say that our issue is more in the rural education communities of Arkansas.
Yes.
We do not have to. Adequacy does not meet equal. And adequacy to fund rural education, you don't have to fund every education system that's out there. You need to fund the ones that are struggling to meet minimum teacher pay to make it competitive. And you see that across the board in rural education or rural school districts. And so I think if we just funded the bottom and we funded them to the point where they could get a competitive teacher salary, we would see a lot of these shortages decrease for those school districts to be able to recruit and retain teachers. And I think it would be a minimum investment. The governor's plan actually was just across the board for every school district, and it was about $117 million plan. I don't think we need $117 million. I think we need about 60. And I think we could make it sustainable for 4 years for about $240, $250 million out of a $600 million surplus that we're playing with. I also think we have a lot of shortages. And I will say this, I'll speak up for teachers, but I will also speak up for our correctional officers. We have a lot of vacancies across the state of Arkansas. It is causing a lot of problems, backups in county jails, because our system does not have adequate spaces, because they don't have adequate personnel. And people who work in corrections are not getting paid a livable wage. And so I think between teachers and correctional officers, I think, those pays should be bumped up. And, we always talk about the price tag of it in the state of Arkansas, but what most people don't realize is that the state of Arkansas also makes money off of state income tax and sales taxes from increased revenues that we would pay for salaries and everything else. So it's not like the state doesn't get a return on that investment. And I think that's important to note. So I think we need to invest in the areas that the state is charged to support and support the people who need it the most and in their profession.
Okay. Rural education, rural schools, rural communities. That's what I do. That's my heart. That's what I love. So I want to pivot to asking a question about consolidation. So you spoke of Lakeview, and one of the outcomes of that was Act 60. The organization I work for is founded. And in 2015, we were able to get the waiver bill passed, and that allows schools to stay open after they get to that 350, as long as they're fiscally, facilities, and academically sound. So I don't know if you're aware of what happened with Sparkman. Sparkman, of course, was forced into consolidation with Harmony Grove years ago, probably at the top of the consolidation, 05, something like that. And most recently, the state board, of course, voted to close their high school.
Right.
So this decision that was made 20 plus years ago has really affected a lot of the rural communities that I work with. I'm now sitting in the former Elaine High School, which is a good resource to the community, but we talk about education, but education is not just inside of those school walls, it's these communities. So moving forward, what do you feel our state should do overall to support these rural communities? So they are places that people can live and have access to things that they need, the basics, because a lot of the communities where rural places, especially where they're dealing with declining numbers and people leaving, they don't have that access. And so what do you feel as a state we should do to support our Delta schools, our very rural places? What do you feel the state's role is in that?
So I actually have a lot of experience with the consolidation part. And I feel very strongly about this because it did affect me early in my education career. Early on, I was teaching at a place, and my first job was at coaching and teaching at a place called Mount Holly Public Schools. Mount Holly Public Schools was 185 kids. The little community paid the second highest property taxes in the state of Arkansas because they wanted their school there. Mm-hmm. And we were referred to as kind of the public-private school, but we were able to take kids, do a lot with them. We had the fourth highest test scores in the state of Arkansas. And our community was thriving. And all that was in that community was the school, a sawmill, and a little store. And that community was happy. They were very pleased where they sent their kids. They felt safe. They felt that they were getting a good education. And then around 2004, consolidation happened, and there was a big push. And most people probably don't remember, but Mike Huckabee was the governor then, and he was pushing for...
I remember.
For one large high school in every county, and to be able to keep elementaries across. Of course, that plan failed.
Yeah.
However, the compromise that came out of that was what we referred to as the 350 rule. Mm-hmm. And so it would shut down all schools, 350 students or under. And the intent behind that was to save money. However, it was proven that it didn't save a dime. When we consolidated to Mount Holly, and I'll give an example of this, my salary starting out was $23,500. That was my starting salary as an educator in the state of Arkansas. This was in 2000 and somewhere around 2003, 2004 time. When we got consolidated, our community actually held a vote, and we voted to be consolidated with Parker's Chapel. And we had several school districts who wanted us, obviously, for our academics. And so they came out and they made presentations to the community, and we held a community vote. They actually voted to go with Parker's Chapel. We filed to go with Parker's Chapel. And when we got before the State Board of Education, they said, no, you're going to go with Smackover. And so we were consolidated with Smackover. They did not listen to our community. And I actually went from making $23,500 to making $38,000 as a teacher, because they took our whole staff to fill their teacher vacancies, and every one of our teachers got a raise. It didn't save in administrative costs. We didn't lose our superintendent. He became assistant superintendent of the Smackover School District. He got a pay increase from what he was making as a superintendent. The only thing that the state really saved was a few dollars on electric bills and facility maintenance. And overall, it proved that it did not save any money. However, what it did do is it destabilized a lot of communities across the state. And you saw the economic downturn from that destabilization. And we have been... seeing those effects play out for the last about 20 years, almost 20 years now. And you see it in the Delta, and you see it in South Arkansas. Of course, Northwest Arkansas wasn't affected by it, but the rest of us were. And so you see those effects in Elaine. You see those effects in Lakeview. You see those effects in Gillette. You see those effects in, there's several other school districts throughout the Delta that I can't think of right off the top
of my head.
But, it destabilized it. And, you look at Elaine. When Elaine had good facilities. The high school there, it was in a very nice, well-kept. Lakeview had good facilities. And what people forget is that schools, or that money flowing into schools, doesn't just flow into that school. It also affects the economy of the communities it's in. From the little local tire shop working with the school buses, to teachers who are on their lunch break and going to eat or ordering food from the local places and buying gas there and living there and paying taxes there. And it destabilized those communities, and you saw economic downturns in those communities, which kind of destabilized a little bit of the Delta and South Arkansas, and has caused a lot of population loss, because communities want to, anybody who lives in any community, you want a good school system, and you want to have a access to that good school system within a reasonable drive. And what you see now is longer drives. You have less community because, I mean, the school is the beating heart. So, I mean, coming out to the football games, identifying like an Elaine as the Panthers and, you know, being a Panther and having that pride. And a lot of communities' pride is centered around the school and the school mascot and how well their ball teams do and the pride that you have from that and the school band and everything else. And so, you know, you see a lot of that. I think that, and I hope that the plan is not moving forward to try to resurrect that model. And I hope that we will see a funding plan, because the state funding matrix is actually designed for schools that are 500 students or more. Yeah. That matrix needs to be adjusted for school districts that are 300 students or more. And it does cost more to educate a child in those models. And that's fine, because it's worth it to those families that are that can't send, don't have the option to send their students to larger school districts. And quite frankly, I've been in rural education for quite a while, and I have a strong opinion. I think rural school districts are able to build better relationships with students and service the needs of students better, get to know your students better than a lot of your large school districts. And I think there are a lot of students who don't thrive very well in large environments that do in small environments. And so I would hope moving forward that we would put it or change the matrix to fund rural school districts at a higher level than lower. So I think the plan should be to starting with 300 person school districts to fund at a higher rate per student, moving all the way up to the 7A level and fund those students at a lower rate, because the larger you are as a school district, the more efficient you are, and it costs less money to run your education system.
Wow. Okay. So given all of that context, I know we have two that are in the race for governor. And I would lie if I said I'm not kind of concerned about one of the candidates' education plan. So if the education plan is one that promotes further consolidation and privatization, what would be your charge to parents, to teachers, on how to move forward and to stand up for their communities?
Well, I think we're seeing a movement right now with educators finally standing up for themselves. I think we've been silent too long, and I think it's time to come alive. In fact, I'll be speaking at a rally tomorrow at the Capitol steps with other educators who are going to speak on teacher pay and what it means. I really think that moving forward, I've only seen one governor candidate put forth an education plan, period. So I'm concerned with what the plan is moving forward from our other candidate. The state has no obligation to fund or, you know, privatize education in any shape, form, or fashion. Mm-hmm. We have no mandates to do that. We do have a mandate to fund public education, and I think that's what we should be focused on. So if things, I would say, you know, we're going to give legislators the benefit of the doubt right now that they are going to do the right thing coming up in this legislative session. But if they don't, I think it's time for teachers to stand up, speak up, and get loud. I think it's time to get heard. And we saw this play out in Oklahoma. Teachers finally had enough. They stood up for themselves, and the legislature met the needs of those teachers and actually did the right thing. And I don't think that they would have if they had not stood up for themselves. There was actually a law that was passed in 2020 in this last legislative session that prohibits teachers from going on strike. But it's a little bit humorous because the law actually says that you shall fire, or the local school board who has the power, the state actually doesn't have the power to fire teachers. The local school board shall fire teachers who actually go on strike, which is still counterproductive if a group of teachers decide to go on strike and the local school board, who are elected officials from the community, decides to fire and terminate the majority of the staff or part of the staff. There's not a surplus of educators out there that they could restock the teacher pool and continue on with school. So it's a little humorous to me to even see that as a state law. It's very weak. There's no penalty. It's not like you have a misdemeanor or you have any kind of charges filed against you. The only thing that the local education, the local education board can do is fire you. And it says you shall do it. But I mean, if locally elected officials don't do it, there's no penalty from the state against them. So I find that a little bit humorous. But I think educators, I'm not advocating necessarily for a strike. I think that we should just step up and do the right thing and just fund teachers at a livable salary. I mean, we're not asking to be rich, but we are asking to make more than a non-degree person who works, say, at a gas station. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm glad they're making $36,000 a year. But we should be paying people who incur a lot of debt to go to school to be able to educate our kids, and who spend a lot of money out of their own pockets to be able to educate kids. We should be funding them at least a livable wage where they don't have to work a second job.
Yes, absolutely. So when I think of rural schools, of course, I think of educators, but I also think of support staff, because my mother was a career paraprofessional for special education. So when we talk about pay, it's just not the educators that are affected in these rural districts. They're janitors, that are paraprofessionals, and especially in rural spaces, they mean so much to those communities. So I hope in the larger conversation, they're the support staff, those who are very instrumental to the school districts, are not forgotten.
I agree with that. And I will add to that, that's actually not something that's in the funding matrix. Mm-hmm. It needs to be added. I don't know why. I mean, we couldn't do what we do as teachers without our support staff. I mean, the people that I work with every day, I've been an educator for 21 years, and you can't do it without your school secretaries, your janitors, your cafeteria workers, bus drivers, maintenance people. I mean, they all play just as big a role in helping to educate students, making sure that they get there on time, that they're able to get from point A to point B for ball games, for classes, and feeding kids every day. And a lot of those salaries are extremely low, and probably the lowest is our cafeteria workers. Bless them. I really don't see how a lot of our cafeteria workers make it on the salaries that they're paid. And I would love to see that be put in the funding matrix, and that they be paid a competitive wage as well, not just educators. I think our whole profession needs that. And I really believe that, especially with our paraprofessionals, a lot of those just they have the heart to be a teacher. And a lot of them would make excellent educators. They just simply don't have the degree. And the reason they don't have the degree is usually they're a single parent, and they don't have the money, and they're especially not going to have the money if they're working as a paraprofessional in school to be able to go back and get those degrees. And I would love for us to be able to pay them a decent wage and actually help them or develop a pipeline there for our paraprofessionals who want to become teachers and provide childcare and everything else. And I've actually have advocated for a plan to do that, for a number of years. We have community colleges all over the state of Arkansas where our paraprofessionals have close access. We have plenty of administrators within the schools that are close to those community colleges. And all of those administrators have the degrees to teach and to become college professors part-time to help train the next workforce. And I think if we utilize a system through our community colleges using our local administrators who have the degrees to actually teach, to be able to put together teacher preparation pipelines in a hybrid model, and for maybe even, to do that at night classes and also count the paraprofessionals' work during the day as their internship classes, and maybe even provide some childcare for them in the afternoon where they don't have to worry about that. I think that that would be a successful model. And I think we would see a lot of our paraprofessionals be able to take advantage of that and become teachers.
I agree. So I have about a few more questions. I love listening to you. I really value your input on this topic. So going into the next legislative session, I know you won't be a representative, but what would you like to see the number one priority be for education?
So I think most educators in the state would agree that we need an overhaul. For quite some time, we've been stagnant in the state of Arkansas in education. I'll attribute that to, I don't think that we've had a lot of educators at the top making educational decisions. I think a lot of that has played into it. I've been very vocal about that from the beginning. I think educators are the best to lead the conversation, not necessarily politicians. So I would say that our number one priority should be teacher pay. We have to get educators interested in this field, to stay in this field, to be able to support them without having to work second jobs. And that has to be a priority. But as far as reform, I believe that across the state of Arkansas, we should build a new model for public education. That model should include, well, and one of the things, I will say this, I've been to over 50 countries. I've looked at probably around 15 educational systems in foreign countries. And I'm convinced more so than ever that in Europe, they have a pretty neat model. It would have to be adapted a little bit for Americans, but I think it would work best. And what that model is they focus basically kindergarten through third grade, and all they focus on is reading, writing, and math, and that's it. And they cut out all the mess. They do have, of course, you know, playtime and free time, mm-hmm. recreation, PE, all those things that are important to the developmental abilities of the child. But they focus on getting those children ready to read or reading by, at a third grade level by third grade. I think that's what we need to do in the state of Arkansas across the board in our elementaries. Starting in fourth grade through eighth grade, I really think we need to put in a model where our kids are not only getting the basics in course, but they are also starting to see the applications of career and technical education. And so it may be learning how to cook. It may be learning how to make something. Of course, all the new technology stuff that kids know way better than adults, but pushing those boundaries a little bit. And I will say that Governor Hutchinson has pushed us forward in that regard as far as computer science is concerned. I think we need to take advantage of that a little bit more across the state, because there are some really good paying tech jobs out there right now. But starting in ninth grade, what you see in a European model is kids choose. And so, well, kids either choose or basically that they're told to go into one or two tracks. And you either go into like a traditional four-year type or prep program for a four-year college track, or you go into a career and technical education track. I don't think that we could do that in the United States, but what we could do is allow parents and students the ability to choose their track each year. And so if we had a kid that wanted to go to a more traditional education, four-year college prep track, then they get to go in that track for that year if they choose a career in technical education. And people think of career in technical education as a lesser degree. It's not lesser. They're the best paying jobs out there right now are actually career and technical education jobs, yes. But it's a different type of job and it's a different type of education. And so preparing English classes, science classes, math classes for those career and technical educational fields are important. And so the kids who want to be career and tech people, they can go all 4 years in high school. The people who want to, or the students who want to go for a four-year traditional, they can do that. Or if you have a kid that doesn't really know, then they can choose one track the next 1 year, one the next year, and you actually have a kid who's exposed to both. And so they would have options. And I think if we built that model here in the state of Arkansas, not only would it be revolutionary, I think we could be the model for the United States. And I think it would completely turn around Arkansas education by just doing those things.
You are so correct. I met a 19, 20 years old, making $6,000 a week.
Yeah.
Welding. You know, so we have to start earlier because a lot, like you say, in these professions, you know, it's been so hard, like finding a plumber, an electrician, HVAC for someone down here to come into the E-Lane. It's so hard, but they make so much money, you know? So I'm with you. Like, we have to start our children earlier thinking about that because, you know, everyone, as we always say, didn't want to go to a four-year. They don't want to do that. But there is something else. I've seen a young guy out of Marvel. He did hair. He's not going to college and he doesn't need to because that's his passion, it's something he loves, and he makes really good money. So, like, being able to support children early on, that's something I would like to see. You kind of answered my next question about, like, what would you like to see in the next 5 to 10 years? I think you answered that already.
I think we have jobs that need to be filled here in the state of Arkansas. I actually flip houses on the western side of the state of Arkansas, and I can tell you from experience from paying plumbers and electricians and sheetrock people and everything else, they make far more money per hour than I do with 10 years and 3 degrees of education, and they work a fraction of the time that I work, so I can tell you conclusively, and every one of those contractors that I have talked to, especially recently, all of them are looking for people, and they're willing to start out at $20-$25 an hour for people who will just come to work and who want to learn the profession. I'm actually having HVAC system installed in one of my places this coming week. The guy that runs the company said, I've got 20 openings right now. And if I could find 20 people, I can pay them $20-$25 an hour and they can work as many hours as they want. And it's just one of those things that I think we've got to change the mindset of parents and students that career and technical education fields are lesser degrees. They're not. They're great living. They're great jobs for people. And we just see a need for that. And you're exactly right. Here in the Delta, we have even less over here. So, I mean, just trying to find somebody. I always joke and say a lot of the properties that I have, I paint out myself because just hiring a painter to come in and paint out will be $3,000-$5,000 just to paint walls. And I joke with students all the time and say, you know, if I got fired today, I could go to painting houses tomorrow, work 20 weeks out of the year and make way more money than I do teaching, 10 months out of the year here. And I said, you know, it just takes people who want to do that. And so I think giving the kids the opportunities and exposing them to that early on and showing them that, hey, these are great jobs. And you can do this in a fraction of the time what it takes to get a college degree, and you don't have the student loan debt. And there's a lot of great schools here in the state of Arkansas that offer those programs. So you just got to get involved and go do it. And I think that's a great model for our state. And I think it's something that parents would get behind and communities would get behind in our school system.
Pie in the sky. What would you like to see for communities, like communities and school districts, like Marvy Lane, Dermot, Fox, Mount Judy? Some of these aren't in your district, but they're very rural school districts. They're very rural places with good communities. What would you like to see for them, pie in the sky? And maybe it's not pie in the sky. Maybe it's some things we really could do to support these districts so they stay around and they thrive.
And so, you know, rural school districts, they do have challenges. Some of those challenges are, of course, low teacher pay. So it's harder to recruit teachers. A lot of your younger teachers are not the kind of teachers who want to come live in a rural community. They want more of the urban environment, a lot of things going on. So rural school districts have challenges in recruiting staff. But I think there are solutions. What I would like to see within the state of Arkansas is a plan to put together. Right now, all school districts are required to have at least 3 career and technical education programs. It's getting harder and harder to find teachers for those programs because the people who run those programs who have experience can make far more working the job than they can teaching the job. Mm-hmm. And so one of the challenges that we find in rural school districts is recruiting quality career and technical education people to run those programs in the schools. So I think the solution that would actually pay for itself would be to create a career and technical education center like we see in Bryan, Arkansas, and create a career and technical education center per county or at least within the region. And so instead of having each one of these school districts have the exact same programs and need teachers for all of those programs, then we could just put those programs into a career and technical education center, offer more programs, and our school districts, especially rural school districts, could bus their kids over there for say a half a day to get those programs in, to have access to those programs. It would save the school districts money because then they would not have to provide those programs as a part of the school. It would also free up spaces for school districts to do other things. But then those community centers at night could be used for adult like GED classes, adult career and technical education trainings, maybe prisoner release skills and trainings, and to use, well, basically make them dual use centers, one for the public education. And even if you wanted to include private and homeschoolers in that, I mean, if taxpayer money is being used for it to have access to those things, but also to have access for our adults in the afternoon to be able to acquire job skills to make them more marketable and to be able to get on their feet. One of the things I have an issue with, and I'll use an example of this. There was a kid that I ran into that I got to know actually through my church. He had been incarcerated when he was, I think, 18 years old for making a prank phone call to the police. He did something very foolhardy. He was in prison for about 2 or 3 years, and then he was released. However, he didn't have family. He didn't have anybody there to pick him up. So he literally walked from Brickies all the way down to Mariana and was living in parks and dugouts and everything else when we finally met him. And, you know, this is a kid. It was a kid when he was put in. He doesn't know. He doesn't have a social security card. He doesn't, you know, have access to anything. I mean, he literally went in with what he what he had and came out with what he had. He has no family support system and everything else. And so this kid's living just basically out on the streets with no ability, because, I mean, you at least have to have a Social Security card to be able to even get a job. And so we took him in. We got him the proper documentation, got him an ID, got him a Social Security card, talked to other employers, finally found him a job. One of the employers started him out. We got put him up for a while he could save up enough money to start paying for a small place on his own and try to get him. But there was no support system for that child, nor and all he was going to do is go back into the system, because at least in the system, he was getting fed and everything else. That's crazy to me. I mean, we need to have a way. And I think if we put these community career and technical education centers, then even the prison systems, when they're releasing people, can say, we're going to get you hooked up with this. And there needs to be a plan for release. I mean, to me, before anybody gets released, they need to have a counselor or somebody or community resources, or at least be told, hey, here's some places you can stay here. We're going to make sure you have the documents you need to be able to be employed. Here are some job training opportunities, and get them hooked up, because all we're doing is just creating a circular pipeline. And you have a lot of kids who make dumb decisions and they drop out of high school. But then as an adult, they realize, hey, I really need to get my GED so I can go to college, or I can go into career and tech classes. I mean, we need to provide those services. And I think for the taxpayer money, I think these career and technical education centers would pay for themselves. Sorry, that was kind of a long answer.
No. That's good stuff. So they will be paid for by like local taxes and things like that.
Well, even state funded career and technical education centers, because if you really think about it, if you took that out of the matrix for school districts to have to provide those three CTE classes, and you put that funding that you take out of the matrix toward the community centers, I mean, it would take an initial investment to build the centers, but there's a lot of vacant buildings within a lot of communities that could be utilized and transformed. We've seen larger school districts like Little Rock utilize buildings that are already built and just transformed over. And so I think it would be a good community revitalization, or at least a way to put a centralized a system of support for both high school students and for adults moving forward. And I think we could save a lot of money, because I mean, if you consolidate your GED programs and it maybe even workforce development and everything else, and have them attached to those centers, that where they could service both high schoolers coming out, going into the workforce, and adults who are wanting to get trained to go back into the workforce, I think you would connect those services better to those constituents.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Whew, this is my last question. And this is something I have bothered you about before. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we've met about it. And it's the infrastructure, especially on this side of the state. I've had people come for meetings down here in Elaine, and they always talk about the conditions of the road. I have tore up so many wheels on P18, taking my son to school over there in Marvel. So that is something that is, you know, very pressing. Our infrastructure, our roads, our water, connectivity, our broadband, and something in addition to that is housing. So, like, what's going on at the state level where our roads don't look like the roads, and I know taxes have a part of it, but we still deserve good roads and water that is not brown.
So I chose to be on the transportation committee because I wanted to learn how all of that worked. I did learn how that works, and unfortunately it doesn't work well. I did not realize that the Arkansas Department of Transportation is actually not under legislative purview or the purview of the governor or anything. They basically operate as a separate entity. And the only time that they are required to interact with us is if they come to us asking for money for projects. Otherwise, basically, what gets funded, when it gets funded, how it gets funded, what money is appropriated to it, is basically just at the discretion of the Arkansas Department of Education. I mean, the Arkansas Department of Transportation. And that really needs to change. We actually have several agencies like that. The Arkansas Game and Fish Commission is one of those agencies, RDOT. And I've learned that being a state legislator, and I did not know that before.
Is that a usual model?
It's actually something that is, it would take a constitutional or a change in the Arkansas Constitution to be able to put them under that. And I really think that that would be a worthy cause. And I think it would pass if we could get enough signatures or have that written up and get enough signatures. I know legislators would be in support of doing those things, because then we could have a little bit more scrutiny over what's going on and where it's going. But I will say this, I have had conversations with Lori Tudor, who's the current head of RDOT, and she has been gracious enough to at least listen. The road from Elaine to down to Snow Lake, which yes. I mean, it's we finally have gotten funding appropriated to, you know, at least do something with that road, which that yeah. was like pulling teeth. So you're going to that, actually the bid opening was in May for that. It was around, I want to say, $10 million.
Oh,
that's been appropriated for that. And so you will see that project going through. We are working on a few other, I can't remember the number, that's going down to Elaine. It's going to get some improvements. I think 242 is going to get some improvements, but we've worked to get some of those addressed. There's still way more that needs to be addressed. I did not realize until I requested it, how many bridges need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. The bridge between Barton and Lakeview, there was one of the bridges down there that was not in good shape, and it's taken them forever to do it, but they are at least replacing it. Mm-hmm. Our bridge at Helena is not the highest quality as far as the safety of it. And I had some concerns about that, especially when our bridge at Memphis showed a crack in it. And then we had increased traffic through this area. Mm-hmm. RDOT is addressing that. And I'm glad to say that there is a project that has been put together to not only, it's not to replace it yet, but mm-hmm. to strengthen it, to repair what needs to be repaired, resurface the bridge, to paint the bridge, and to actually get it in a state where it can last about another 30 or 40 years before being replaced. I actually asked how much it would cost to replace it, and the price tag of that was over $1 billion. $1 billion. So, you know, the state doesn't have the resources to be able to just replace a bridge like that. And I always want to know how much things cost, because I don't know if we're talking about $100 million or $1 billion or what we're talking about, but they said it's over $1 billion. And so it would require federal funding.
So federal funding would do that. Okay.
Well, we would have to have match federal funding. I will say this. I have spoke to Sarah Huckabee Sanders about this when she came down. She said that it would be a priority of hers to address that. We'll see what can be done. Hopefully there will at least be some federal intervention there if she gets elected. If Chris Jones gets elected, I would hope that he would intervene and ask for federal funding, because really, truly, it's something that's going to need to be replaced. It really needs to be expanded to a 4-lane. Because I mean, there's not many places to cross the Mississippi River currently, and you know, we definitely need to make sure that those roads and bridges are in tip-top shape. To your point, we definitely need to address a lot of our back roads. I will say this, RDOT has told me that the local state department that's located right outside of Barton is responsible for making sure that those roads are being maintained more. And so I think, and I do know this, the more complaints that are filed on roads, that is what gets a lot of, that's the system that triggers what gets the attention. So what we need to be doing is identifying, I think the plan needs to be, what we need to do is identify the roads and areas that need to be addressed and be specific, put those out on social media as well as the link to file those complaints with RDOT. And I think if we started to do that, then we would see a lot more attention being drawn to those specific areas. So I think that's something that we definitely need to look into.
Thank you for giving like the, like how to do this. So identifying the roads and then putting the link to file the complaint. That's very important information, because I didn't know the exact process. So that's good. If you could email me the link, I'd like that.
I definitely will.
Water. What do we do about our failing water systems?
Yeah, so of course, you know, water systems are the responsibility of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's rural water, and then there are some grants that are out there. Primarily, those are mayor responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And so getting and writing grants for rural water systems, upgrades, everything else, waters. But I think that we need to have some more audits really on some of these water systems to see where that money's going. The money that's being collected by the cities and how it's being spent to upgrade and maintain a lot of our facilities, because I see a lot of funding going toward water, but I don't see where it's being spent on upgrading and maintaining the systems. And I think that's a city by city issue. I think some cities do a better job of it than other cities. It is expensive to do, but we are in the land or in agriculture land, and we do have a lot of services and suppliers around here who build pipelines, who can maintain pipelines, who can replace pipelines. And so we do have the ability and resources to be able to make those upgrades, especially with grant money. But I think requesting audits on a lot of those systems to make sure that money is going to where it's supposed to be going. And most people don't realize this, but water systems are not audited by the state unless they're requested to be audited.
You said the water systems are not audited unless they request it?
That's correct. And so the state does not audit water systems unless people request that they be audited. And so
citizens, residents can request it, or it takes the mayor?
I believe residents can request it. I'm not sure on that process. I've actually sent an email last week out to find out how that process works, because it was something that I was not aware of, that I've been made aware of. I've had numerous complaints from several constituents on where the money is going from these water systems and how it's being spent to maintain the water systems and make upgrades and things. And so I know that in the state of Arkansas, there have been cases where, since water systems aren't audited unless requested, that there has been some fraud. One of those places was right outside of Texarkana. There was a mayor who was basically letting their family use water systems for free. They weren't having to pay for their bills. Money was being diverted by the city council from water systems to other areas. And finally, the residents got enough, and somehow, whatever the process is, they went through the process for it to be audited. And of course, all of that came out at that time. And so I have seen cases across the state of Arkansas where cities and even city councils have diverted money from water system payments to be able to be used in other areas. And so I think that's something that residents need to keep an eye out on. And I think that they need to request. I personally think they should be audited every year, just like other state funding or local funding, especially when cities get audited, because I do think that, you know, I just believe in accountability. I mean, if you're going to take money, I think you should be accountable for where that money is going and how it's being spent. But that's ultimately up to the people that you elect as city council members to ask those questions, as well as you know, your mayor candidates. And so I think those are concerns. I think it's conversations that need to be held. And I, you know, if you're a government official, I think you should be transparent where that money is coming from, what's being taken in, and how it's being spent. And I think those are reasonable questions to be asked by constituents. I don't think any of that should be hidden. It is FOIable from what I understand as well. Yeah.
Okay, because it's a public entity. Okay. The housing issue. A lot of communities, especially rural, very rural places. We were talking about younger teachers earlier and the amenities that, you know, they would like to have. They'll work in the districts, but they'll live somewhere else. One, because housing is not there. So I know you said you do, you know, do rentals in other parts of the state. How do we address the housing issue?
And so housing is a concern. When I was superintendent at Barton, the number one thing when I would hire a teacher is, hey, where are we going to live? Is there a place around that you can live in? And my answer was not in Barton. You know, there's just not a whole lot of housing options there. I would have to recommend that they would talk to a real estate agent, or there are several people who have rental properties we would refer them to. So housing is a difficult issue. I really think that it's something that, especially for educators, that can be addressed from the local perspective. I think if we found people who are willing to invest in properties for educators, who would rent it to educators, I think those are good opportunities and investments for local community members, as well as providing a service for the community in general. Mm-hmm. I will say this, it is a good investment, especially if you're renting to somebody you know has an income and is going to be able to pay those bills every month. I don't know of any superintendent or school administrator who, if somebody had a rental property and came up to the school and say, hey, I would like to really rent to educators, or your new teachers and everything else, here's some cards, you know, I have some places open, would you mind giving them my name? I really don't know of anybody who would say no to that. It is a concern. That's one of the things that you will see at Barton. For the superintendents, the superintendent's house was in the middle of campus. It was built in like the 1920s, and the campus built up around it. So literally it was living in the middle of campus. Wow. And it was not a house that was in very good shape at all. And so in the new reconstruction of plans and everything else, the house was going to have to be torn down. So there was a delinquent property that was across the street from the school district, and we bought that out of foreclosure.
Well, that's the superintendent. Yes. I was wondering what happened. Yeah. Okay.
We bought that out of foreclosure and remodeled it for the superintendent, because the superintendent at Barton is required to live in district. Mm-hmm. It is for insurance purposes for the district to have somebody who lives on campus to be able to watch and maintain things and through the night. And really, until you've lived on a campus, you really don't know what all goes on in the night. And I will say that it's a good thing to have. I was able to avoid a flooding incident one time that would have caused problems and everything else. There's been several other times when I lived on campus that we've been able to save a lot of taxpayer money from a pot breaking or freezing or something that may be a potential fire or something that somebody who's trying to break into a school or something like that. So We were able to renovate that house, improve the community around, of course, the look of the community, as well as improve the houses there, and provide a place for the superintendent to live, because there's just simply not anything. I mean, the superintendent's required to live in the district, and there's really not a whole lot to rent or buy within that district. And so teachers face the same thing. So I would love to see investments from local community members in some housing things. And I think that they would do well. I know that teachers from Kip, from Helena, from Lee County, from Marvel, from Barton, I mean, I get calls all the time for teachers who are moving into this area. Do you know anybody? Can I talk to anybody? And it's just referrals. And most of the people that I know that rent properties, their properties are rented. So I think if somebody wanted to invest in that, I think it would be an extremely good investment in this area.
I think so too. Even if it's like a tiny home, I think that is a great answer, like our housing shortage. I'm done with questions. I know I'm gonna miss you being in the legislator in Arkansas. You have manned your word. You were always easy to contact. Even back, I guess, to being a superintendent, I remember when you passed the millage increase. And you said that the parents wouldn't have to worry about school supplies anymore. You are a man of your word. So I'm going to miss your support. I guess Representative Wooten have to be there by himself.
Yeah, he's going to have to carry the burden, I think, on this next go around.
He's going to have to carry that torch for public education alone. But I just really, really appreciate your service to this district. I really do. And I hope you're not finished. Do you have any parting words or anything you would like to say or add?
Well, I just like to say I appreciate those kind of words, and I've always taken this responsibility. I never thought I'd be a state representative, honestly. It's not something I don't come for money. I don't have the right last name or anything else, and so getting into those positions a lot of times is very difficult. But I've always felt the sense that, you know, if you don't try, you don't have as much of a voice. And, you know, I think if more people tried, I think you would see a lot of people succeed to get in there and be a voice for education and educators. And I've encouraged a lot of educators to think about running for public office, educators who are current as well as retired, because we need more voices for public education in the state legislature. In fact, all of our good public education people are pretty well being wiped out of the Arkansas House. This going around, they're not running for office again, or they're stepping out. And so I have a lot of concerns, but it has been my honor and privilege to serve as the state representative of District 12. I've enjoyed listening to constituents. I've enjoyed learning the process. I've definitely learned a lot about state government once I got into it and how things really work and the processes. And so I've been able to do what I can with such a limited amount of time that I've had in there, but I've enjoyed my time here. I just wanted, my whole goal when I ran was just to be able to help people where I can. And I think I've done that to the best of my ability. I may not have always made people happy, but you know, that's part of it. And I'm a former school superintendent, so I'm used to that. So, but what I've always tried to do is help people every opportunity I've been able to. And so yes. I'm hoping that moving forward, public education will gain a voice, and that the legislators will do the right thing, and only time will tell.
Yeah, we still have some legislators up there that are fighting, and
they are.
Yep, they are fighting, and I really appreciate it. Rural Community Alliance will definitely be behind them.
Yeah,
because we need public schools to thrive. So
yes, yeah. We do.
Well, thank you for giving me your time. I didn't think it was going to be this long, but just listening to you and talking to you has been an honor and just learning. So thank you so much today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You take care.
You too.
Thank you again for joining us for another episode of our Representing Rural podcast. I want to send a special thank you out again to Representative Tarlette for giving us his time. Full disclosure, I think I mentioned this in the episode, but he was fresh off of vacation. You know, it was a Saturday, you know, of course, having to start his Monday and get back into professional development as an educator and as a legislator, having to go into the special session, which I'll talk about in a little bit, but that's commitment. That's time. That's a public servant. And I just want to tell you again how much I appreciate you doing that for me, Representative Tarlette. So I'll go right into our rural power moves. The first would be to try to stay informed and engaged with this special session that's going on. As you all may know, Arkansas's Governor Asa Hutchinson did call the legislature into special session for two agenda items. The first being tax cuts, the second being school safety. As you may know, we have $1.6 billion surplus, so they have some money to spend. And the two agenda items that I guess enough consensus was around were the tax cuts and school safety. Of course, there has been a cry for educators' pay. Teachers, educators, support staff deserve a raise. From what I'm understanding today, which is the first day of session, Tuesday, August the 9th, is that if something were to happen around that, it would happen on Thursday or Friday after this special session ends. So nothing else will be added into this special session. Only those two agenda items. That's been very, very clear. That has been made very clear. So the second rural power move would just to be make sure that you are informed of the status of your voter registration. Make sure everything is good. We're in this last leg of voting season for election season. So just want to make sure, and RCA is doing it. We call them engagement drives where we work with the communities that we're engaged with, and we have our voter registration forms. We have access to a computer and internet where people can check their voter registration. We have information on the voting laws that changed in 21. And leading up to the election, we will also have information on the ballot initiative. So people are informed before they get to the ballot box on or in November or before they early vote or absentee ballot. Whatever the case may be, we just want to be a source of information for our rural communities. That's it. That's all. Well, that's not this. That's it. That's all. But that is an important part of what we do. We want to make sure our people are informed and they have the tools that they need, you know, to go in there and be confident with the vote that they make or the person that they select or the ballot initiative, how they vote on it. We just want to be a source of information for those things. So those are my rural power moves. This episode, of course, was longer than usual, but it was just so much. And I feel like it's a conversation that does not stop here. We're just sticking a pin in it. But, you know, this is how RCA was founded. Public education, advocating for our rural public schools and communities. So this is just sticking a pin in it, but this is a rural candidate that I wanted our listeners to hear from. So thank you all for joining us. You all take care.